Gopina Shimakundarada Kundagiri Govardhana Ki Jai Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai Gaura Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nivasesis and Nivali Bhaskatyade Satarane. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavamscha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Samsajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Vanchakalpa Chubischaki Bisanviya Vataptitam Pavanevyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it's June 19th, 2020, in Gainesville, Florida, over Zoom, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 26, Fundamental Principles of Material Nature, Text 71. Do you also want me to do Text 70? Or did you already discuss 70? Because 70 has no purport and is very connected. Okay, so just to review this chapter, this 71, so we're going to do 70 and 71. 71 is the penultimate verse in this chapter. And this chapter is discussing what is called in the secular world the philosophy of science. So it's explaining the relationship between the person, the world in general, the sense objects, and the senses. Who are we, and how do we interact with the world? How do we experience what we experience? And the relationship between the individual living being and the world is explained here in this chapter in terms of the universal form, in terms of the whole universal body. So you have the whole universal body that has his own senses and his own soul. And the different senses of the universal body are run by persons, run by demigods. Actually, our senses are also run by various demigods. So there's this comparison, which is very common in all of the yoga scriptures, to our own body and how we interact with the world and the universal body of the Lord. And it's a lot of detail here about the universal form that mirrors and expands on and explains in a little different way the descriptions of the universal form in the second canto of the Bhagavatam. So there's also a description, of course, of the universal form in the eighth canto of the Bhagavatam in relationship to Vamandev. And these descriptions of the universal form and our interactions with the world and our interactions with the universal form are really unique in terms of the major religions on this planet. So the major religious systems on this planet, other than that coming from the Vedas, do not go into detail about our relationship with the world and the nature of the world. You know, we often talk about how they don't go into detail about the nature of God in his original form as Bhagavan, but nor do they go into detail about our relation with the world. And of course, the Isha-Upanishad says that we should study both side by side. So there's a great depth of richness in this Sankhya philosophy. So we're going to look today at text 70 and 71. I guess we'll read 71, we'll read the Sanskrit to 71, and then we'll go back and read the translation to 70 and the translation to 71 and the purport to 71. Okay, the Sanskrit for text 71. Yata prasuptam purusham. Pranendriya manodhyaha. Pravavanti vinayena. Natopayitamojasa. Please chant. Yata. Just as. Pasuptam. Sleeping. Purusham. Amen. Prana. The vital air. Indriya. The senses for working and recording knowledge. Manaha. The mind. Diyaha. The intelligence. Prabhavanti. Are able. Vina. Without. Yena. Whom? The Supersoul. Na. Not. Utapaitum. To arouse. Ojasa. By their own power. Okay, so I want to read the translation to text 70. However, when the inner controller, oh, we should give a little background to this. So the universal form is not active. And so all the different demigods, along with the senses that they control in the universal form, have entered into the universal form to make the universe active. However, the universe remains inactive, as if sleeping. So text 70 is, however, when the inner controller, the deity presiding over consciousness, entered the heart with reason, at that very moment the cosmic being arose from the causal waters. And today, and text 71, what's not translated here is yata. Yata is just as. So there's a comparison being made here between the cosmic being and an ordinary person. Translation, when a man is sleeping, all his material assets, namely the vital energy, the senses for recording knowledge, the senses for working, the mind and the intelligence, cannot arouse him. He can be aroused only when the Supersoul helps him. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The explanation of Sankhya philosophy is described here in detail in the sense that the Virat Purusha, or the universal form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the original source of all the various sense organs and their presiding deities. The relationship between the Virat Purusha and the presiding deities or the living entities is so intricate that simply by exercising the sense organs, which are related to their presiding deities, the Virat Purusha cannot be aroused. It is not possible to arouse the Virat Purusha or to link with the Supreme Absolute Personality of Godhead by material activities. Only by devotional service and detachment can one perform the process of linking with the Absolute. So here we have an allegory. So Lord Kapila Dev is, in explaining to his mother the nature of reality, the nature of the universal form, the nature of the cosmic being, he relates that description to something with which we are all familiar. We're sleeping, and how is it that we wake up? We only wake up by the grace of God. We can't wake up just simply by the interaction of our senses or by our intelligence. I mean, it's kind of mysterious, actually, as to why we wake up. If you think about sleeping when you don't have an alarm and nobody comes to wake you up, what is it that at a certain point our body wakes up? Even how is it that we fall asleep? You know, any of you who've spent time around infants, very young babies, you'll notice that very often young babies, and even children will do this, when they're tired, instead of going to sleep, they cry. It's very common that little babies, I'm staying next door to my granddaughter and her husband, and they have a 4-month-old and a 2-year-old, And even with the two-year-old sometimes, when he's tired, instead of just going to sleep, he'll just be grumpy. I mean, even we adults sometimes do that, right? When we're really tired, instead of going to sleep, we're just grumpy. So little babies, they just cry. And one of the reasons that the babies cry is they don't know how to put themselves to sleep. I mean, obviously babies just kind of fall asleep, but they don't know some process. What do I do so that when I do this thing, I'm likely to fall asleep? And of course, we know even among adults, there are insomniacs who have really have a difficult time activating the sleep mechanism, that even when they're really tired and they're suffering because they're tired, they're not quite sure how to start the sleep mechanism. And if you think about it, how do we fall asleep? I mean, we've just set up some sort of conditioned response that if I'm, you know, lying flat, I close my eyes and so forth, especially if we're lying in a particular place at a particular time of the day, and we can it invokes this sleeping response. But we're not really sure how we do it. I mean, like, we're not really sure how we digest our food either. So we really don't know how it is we fall asleep, and we really don't know how it is we wake up. And you could say, well, we can wake ourselves up through an alarm or through a friend, but that doesn't always work. I'm staying in a house with another devotee, and sometimes she doesn't wake up to her alarm. The alarm was just ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. You know, so we can set our alarms, at least like on an electronic device, so that after a certain number of minutes, it automatically turns off. Well, she hasn't set it like that, so it'll keep ringing. And she said to me, you know, Urmila, if you hear my alarm ringing and ringing, you can wake me up. But I feel a little hesitant to go and say, your alarm's ringing, you know, do you want to get up? So anyway, we have the experience that even setting an alarm doesn't always wake us up. And sometimes we incorporate the alarm into a dream, right? I'm sure we've all had that experience, that, you know, like we're having a dream that the smoke alarm is ringing and we're trying to turn it off and we can't, or, you know, or a car alarm or something, or you know, we're telling our friend, would you turn that music off or something, you know, and it's in our dream. So what wakes us up? What puts us to sleep? What wakes us up? It's beyond our power. This is done ultimately by God. It's not really done. It's not really something that's just happening materially. And in a similar way, this is Kapila, Lord Kapila is giving this allegory or this analogy. In a similar way, the whole universe is only activated by God. And it's very often that the universe is compared, before this activation by the Lord, the universe is compared to something that's sleeping. In fact, in another place in the Bhagavatam, it states that the Lord, it's like he has different, he's more than one wife, he has his internal energy, and he has his external energy. And his external energy, when she's sleeping, sometimes he wants to wake her up to enjoy her. Just like, you know, an ordinary husband might wake up his wife, hey, you know, let's go take a walk outside. Let's have some breakfast. Let's have some fun. So that the Lord wants to wake up the material energy. And the way he wakes up the material energy is he actually enters into the material energy. Now, in one sense, the energies of the Lord and the Lord are the same. But you could still say he enlivens that energy. He takes his spiritual energy and enlivens it. Another allegory which is given all the time that Srila Prabhupada gives is a car and a driver, or an airplane and a pilot. That the car or the plane, you know, it doesn't matter what's done to it unless a driver drives it, unless, you know, just turning things or moving things without some living force getting involved and driving the car or flying the plane, it doesn't matter what parts are there. You can't say that, well, there's wheels, there's fuel in the tank, you know, the battery's charged, there's a carburetor, there's an engine, and there's an exhaust system, so it's going to drive. No, somebody has to drive it. I suppose one could have some system to drive it remotely, but someone has to drive it. So these allegories are very important because spiritual knowledge, spiritual understanding, is both the original of which this world is a reflection and something categorically different. It's both. Just like if we think about the activities of Bhagavan. So Krishna's dancing with young girls, a young boy dancing with young girls. Oh, I know what that is. I've seen young boys dancing with young girls. Maybe I've even had a dance, and I've gone to a dance, and I've danced with a young boy, or I've danced with a young girl. Oh, I know what that is. So in one sense, it's similar, because janma yasa yataha, everything that's here is coming from Krishna. In another sense, it's completely different. It really doesn't have a comparison at all. You know, and you could say that, well, you know, if like right now is mango season in the hot climates, you know, if you get a mango tree ripened, organically grown in your backyard, not shipped, you know, you pick it from the tree when it's ripened and you have that ripe mango, that has something to do with some chemically created mango flavor in a laboratory that's added to water and sugar. You know, you took water, you took sugar, and you put in this chemical mango flavor. There's some relationship between that and an actual mango. But they're completely different. So these allegories are there because if we just go to the completely different, if we just say Krishna's dancing with the gopis, Krishna's loving Mother Yasoda, Krishna's playing with the cowherd boys, the desire trees, the river Yamuna, they're completely different from anything that we experience, then we have a very difficult time to meditate on them at all. And we're supposed to be meditating on these pastimes. So therefore, there's some analogy given. Well, it's something like, just like Prabhupada would say that the pure love in this world, it can be somewhat experienced between a mother and a child. Oh, okay, something like that. And that allows us to start meditating. I mean, in these chapters by Lord Kapiladev, he has a statement, I think it's in the 28th chapter, text 34, I believe, where he says that the mind is used as a hook to capture the Lord. And Prabhupada writes in that purport that eventually meditation doesn't involve the mind at all. But how do we use the mind as a hook to capture the Lord? We have to have something that we can understand, something that we can hold on to, that to say to ourselves, well, it's something like this. So when we want to meditate on how does the Supreme Lord manifest the universe, how does he enliven it, how does he make it work, we can say it's something like the same way he makes our body go to sleep and the same way he makes our body wake up. We have experience of sleeping and waking up. We know it's not entirely under our own power. And a similar thing happens with the universe. So the universe is a body. It's a material body that has a soul. Queen Kunti in her prayers talks about the soul of the universe, Vishva Atma. So the soul of the universe is the Supreme Lord. We also call him the Paramatma. And again, only when he enters these elements is it alive. What's fascinating about this understanding is, when I, the soul, enter my body, then I am conscious of every part of my body, although the body is a machine. My individual consciousness is spread throughout the body, so that I am conscious of my hand, right? If something touches my hand, I can feel the thing that's touching my hand. Yes, I have awareness of it, and that's true even with my nails. So the end of my nails are completely dead, but yet I'm still able to sense what's happening in my nails. Now, I have individual cells, so within the skin of my fingers are individual cells, and they are also aware. So if I'm holding this pen, the individual cells in my fingers are, they have an awareness that something is touching them. Of course, they're not able to ascertain that it's a pen. They can't understand that. They have a very low level of intelligence. But they have some awareness. But I'm also aware. So the individual cells are aware, and I am aware. And Srila Prabhupada writes that we are like individual cells in the universal body. So I am aware of what's happening with me. And because I'm a cell in this universal body, the Lord is also aware of what's happening with me. And He's directing me. I'm directing my fingers. And when I direct my fingers, all the little cells in my fingers generally obey my command. And Krishna is directing us. And we generally obey His command. If we don't, then we're a disturbance. And I'm aware and He's aware. Now, in my body, it's made up of living cells, but it also has some dead cells, like the ends, the white part at the end of my fingernails is dead, and this hair is dead. There's no living cells in my hair and in my fingernails, but I'm also aware of what's happening with my hair. I have some awareness of my hair, and I have some awareness of the ends of my fingernails, although my hair and the ends of my fingernails have no awareness of themselves. So in a similar way, the Lord has awareness of the living entities, the cells in the universal body, that is ourselves, all the jivas, and He also has awareness of the dead matter that isn't aware of itself. So this pen is not aware of itself, but Krishna is aware of it. And Krishna's not aware of it like I am. I'm looking at it. I'm aware of it by touching it and looking at it, you could say, from the outside. However, Krishna is aware of it also from the inside, just like I am aware of my hair from the inside. I have a consciousness of my hair. So by comparing like this our own body to the body of the universe, we have some understanding of how everything works. Now, Srila Prabhupada is taking this allegory to another step. So Lord Kapila Dev is taking this allegory to compare the universal body with the Paramatma to my body with me, the soul. And Srila Prabhupada in this purport is taking this as an allegory to our relationship, not just with the Paramatma and with the universe, but with Bhagavan, the supreme absolute personality of Godhead. So he's saying that this verse is also an allegory that we cannot wake up our relationship with the Lord except by the grace of the Lord. So Kapila Dev is saying, hey, you can't wake up from sleep unless the Lord wakes you up. Again, we can't even go to sleep unless the Lord allows us to go to sleep. Yes? Daivye Shaguna Mayi Mama Maya Dharachana Mam Evaye Prapajante Mayam Etam Tarantite. Prabhupada wrote in his poem when he arrived in America that the living entities are all in illusion by your grace, and they can only wake up by your grace. So we have the little illusion that happens every time we go to sleep. Right? We all go into some state of illusion when we're sleeping. When we're in deep sleep, we're in so much illusion that we hardly even know that we exist, and we certainly don't know where we are. We're not getting any sensory input at all when we're in deep sleep, and our only memory of deep sleep is to say, oh, I slept deeply, right? And then we're in a state of illusion in dreaming, where in dreaming I may be in a different place, I'm with different people, I'm doing different things than my body's actually doing. You know, I'm running here or there, or eating a meal with somebody, or something. That's an illusion. And that ability to go into that illusion of the dreaming state and deep sleep is given by the Lord, and the ability to come out of that is also given by the Lord. Just like the whole universe goes bhutva praliyate, goes into destruction and a sleeping state, a dormant state, which just means sleeping in French, and a waking state. But there's another kind of sleeping state And there's another kind of waking state, you could say the metta, sleeping and waking, which is being in a general illusion and being in knowledge in general. Because when I go to sleep at night, or if I take a nap during the day and then I wake up, both of those states, or all three of them, deep sleep, dreaming, and wakefulness, are all simply varieties of an illusion. I'm not really awake, awake. You know, often people call enlightenment or whatever a spiritual awakening. And people who are spiritually awake, people who are enlightened, people who are liberated, will often describe that before that point they were sleeping, that their ability to understand things was compromised, that they're much more alive and awake and alert and seeing the truth in their liberated or awakened state than they ever were in any normal waking state. So in a similar way, as I say, Prabhupada's carrying this to another allegory in his purport, to the fact that I'm dependent on the Lord for ordinary sleep and ordinary wakefulness, I'm also dependent on the Lord for this existential sleep and the existential awakening, for the ultimate awakening. Now, we'll notice, though, that when I go to sleep in my ordinary sleep, it's because I want to, generally. I mean, sometimes I'm sure we've all tried to force ourselves to stay awake or been in some circumstance where sleep was very difficult, and we kind of fall asleep against our will. You know, we're trying to pay attention to something and we're just kind of falling asleep because we haven't allowed ourselves to get our normal sleep. But generally, when we go to sleep, it's because we want to. We're basically, you know, we're putting our body and mind into the place where we have a conditioned response, where we've been trained since infancy that we're going to fall asleep. And this is our way of communicating to the Lord, I want to go to sleep now. You know, I do whatever is my ritual. You know, I brush my teeth, I use the toilet, I open up the bed and arrange the pillow and turn off the light, maybe put on some special clothes for sleeping, and so many things. And this is signaling to the super soul, I want to go to sleep. By setting an alarm, I'm signaling to the super soul, I want to wake up at this particular time. Or some people just think, you know, they picture 3 o'clock in the morning in their mind, that's when I want to wake up. In a similar way, again, because we're looking here at these allegories, in a similar way, when I want to be an illusion, I communicate to the Lord that I want to try to be the controller, I want to try to be the center, I want to try to be the enjoyer. And then he facilitates that and says, all right, then you can't do this in reality, therefore I will facilitate your doing this in illusion. And similarly, when we want to wake up, when we want to become enlightened, when we want to enter into love of God, we signal this to the Lord, and he also facilitates it. Therefore, Prabhupada writes that the unhappy living entities in this world can get out of illusion simply by desiring to do so. Now, we might say, well, I desire to do so, and it seems to be taking some time. If we're honest, and, you know, we may not be honest all the time, because it's sometimes a little difficult, but if we're honest, we'll see that we don't really want to be spiritually enlightened 100%. If we did, we would be. I mean, if we did, we would be. If we 100% wanted to realize God and love Him, in one moment we would. The reason that we're not fully Krishna conscious, if we're not fully Krishna conscious, maybe some of you are, is because our desires are mixed. We're like, well, I want to surrender to Krishna, but I want to keep, you know, my idea of being an independent Lord. So the idea of, and that, every once in a while at least, we become aware of that truth. You know, I remember years ago when a devotee was quoting to me, Prabhupada's quoting a Bhaktisiddhanta, that Krishna is a transcendental autocrat. It was just a casual conversation. Some devotees were taking prasadam, and one of the devotees said, yes, Krishna is a transcendental autocrat. And I could feel a resistance within my body. I could feel that something was going, no, I don't want Krishna to be the autocrat. I'm an American. I don't like autocrats. And it was this strong, you know, rebellion. And I was shocked. And I was like, whoa, no wonder I'm not a pure devotee. You know, I don't want to be a pure devotee. I'm like, I want to surrender to some transcendental autocrat. So, you know, sometimes it becomes obvious. Sometimes Krishna makes it obvious that our desires are mixed. Yes? So how are we going to get Krishna to wake us up on the transcendental absolute platform? Because we're only going to wake up by his mercy. Well, he's only going to wake us up when he's convinced we want to fully wake up, because Krishna doesn't force anything on us. He's just not like that. He's not a rapist. He's a beloved. He doesn't believe in force. I mean, Krishna's so extreme about not believing in force that if we have even a little tinge of hesitancy, he says, fine, I'll wait until you're 100% sure. I mean, you know what it's like in our human relations. Somebody will say to us, do you want to do that? And we go, well, not really. And they say, well, you know, it might be this, might be this. They try to convince us, right? And we're not really convinced. But we like the person. We don't want to offend them or whatever. We have some other motive. And so we say, okay, I'll do that. But there's still a part of us that's going, right? So Krishna's not interested in a relationship with us if there's still a little grumbler. You know, if there's still some voice that's going, well, I don't really want to do that. Do I have to? Well, Prabhupada wrote it. It's in the scriptures. And, that was the agreement I made with the ISKCON authorities here, that I would do that. If I don't do that, they're not going to feed me. And, you know, okay. And there's a part of us that goes, yeah, I really want to do that. I want to love Krishna. I want to go back to Godhead. So, yes, I want to do that. And another part, and as long as there's the little, you know, grumbler guy, then Krishna's, you know, his reciprocation with us is going to be accordingly. So the way that we invoke the mercy of Krishna to wake us up is by increasing that desire to wake up. Krishna explains this in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, text 9, where he says, if you don't already have a complete desire, then engage in abhyas yoga. Abhyas yoga is another way of saying sadhana bhakti. Abhyas means to repeat. Engage in abhyas yoga and develop icha, develop a desire. And of course, Rupa Goswami says the same thing. The only price is having a desire. So we awaken this desire not by falsely convincing ourselves that we have it when we don't. You know, oh yes, I am so pure. Doesn't work. Sorry. You can try it, but I speak from experience. But what we do is we rishikesha rishikena sevanam bhakti ruchate, which is also kind of the theme of this chapter. I use my senses the way they're supposed to be used. If I'm a cell in the universal body, then just like my bodily cells, they obey me. They have their own independence. Each cell in my body has its own independent life. And the cells, frankly, they don't have much volition because their consciousness is not very developed, but they do have to use their volition to serve me. And how do we know that that's the case? Because sometimes a cell will use its volition to rebel. A cell in the body may decide, well, I'm not going to serve the body, I'm going to serve my own agenda. And what do we call that disease?
Cancer.
Cancer, yes. So I can be a cancer in the universal body. I have that choice. Yeah, I have volition. I have free will. Now, generally, a conditioned soul, the way a conditioned soul uses their natural propensity to serve and be part of a greater whole is to try to serve their senses independently, just like a cancer cell. Now, of course, we don't admit that we're doing that. We say, I'm serving my country. You know, we have political leaders, we won't name any names, but we have political leaders who say to the public, I'm serving the country. I'm not serving my own interests, I'm serving the country. And perhaps they believe that. I don't know what somebody else believes. Maybe they believe that. But in many cases, it's extremely obvious to anybody that they're not serving the country, they're serving their own interests in the name of serving the country. Yes, we've seen this with political leaders. I'm sure all of you can think of a number of names. And we see this with business managers. You know, again, I'm not going to name names, but we can think of business managers that are worth themselves millions or billions of dollars, which it's impossible to spend that much money. You can't spend it. And their employees are just barely eking by. And so the business leader will say, I'm working for the good of the company. And we look at it and we say, well, maybe you believe that, but really you're working for yourself. So we may say to ourselves, and we do, I'm serving my parents, my spouse, my children, my friends, the organization I'm a part of, my country, the school that I go to, the business that I do. But the reality is that we're serving our own senses. We're serving our own interests. And again, it is not something we like to say. It's very unpalatable. But we really can't progress unless we know the truth. The evidence that I'm serving my own senses instead of everyone I say I'm serving is when the people or the organization, the group of people, whatever, that I claim to be serving doesn't facilitate my own personal satisfaction, I become disturbed. And often I will blame the people that I say that I'm serving. Another evidence that Prabhupada brings up all the time is that those I'm serving often get disturbed with me. That they don't necessarily appreciate or even recognize my service. They're not even aware of my service. They may not be grateful. In fact, they may be critical of my service. So I have the problem that if my service isn't reciprocated the way that I want, then I become disturbed and I have the situation that the people, the person, or the persons that I'm serving are not always satisfied with me. So something's not really happening there. Something's not really happening there. The what appears to be happening in terms of service is not really happening. I'm being selfish and everyone else is also being selfish. People are not, the apparent relationships that hide our true, rather ugly motives are not what they appear to be. That's what the meaning of Maya is, something that's not what it appears to be. But the fact that we are serving our own interests in the name of serving others is very good news. Because it means I know how to be apparently doing something while doing something else. And that's exactly what we need to do spiritually. We need to be apparently working in the world, apparently working under material designations, but actually serving Krishna. So just like I know how to serve my tongue and my ear and my eye, I know how to serve my ego and my pride, I know how to do that. I'm really good at that. So in the same way, I could serve the master of all those things. I could serve the master of my tongue. I could serve the master of my ears, even the master of my ego, even the master of my pride, even the master of my anger. Isn't that interesting? You know, when I may appear to be serving like people, I mean, I'm just going to be very frank. You know, people out there protesting for Black Lives Matter, you know what a lot of those people are serving? Their own anger. Anger is exciting. It's a rasa. Right? When we get really angry, then we feel energized and we feel important. We feel powerful. And the vast majority of political rallies, sporting events, are simply people having an excuse to enjoy anger or to enjoy disgust, horror, you know, to enjoy horror. Oh, I'm so horrified about what this person has done, oh, they really did such a horrible thing, the bibhatsu rasa, or fear, to enjoy fear. So it appears that, you know, oh, we're working for social justice, and we're working for this, and we're working for that, and we're working for the other thing, and we're not. We're working for our own enjoyment, and we're working for our own ego. So what's done in spiritual life is you work for social justice, you work for your family, you work for society, but your real master you're serving, instead of your own anger, your own disgust, your own fear, your own compassion, that's another rasa, and your own ego, is you're serving Krishna. And the problem is, when we do material service, but we're actually serving our own senses and our own ego, is no matter how wonderful the service appears to be, whether we're serving, you know, people who are exploited, or whether we're serving our family, or whether we're serving our business, it's all cancerous. And that's the reason why things just don't get better. You know, something gets better on the one hand, and then something pops up on, what is it, like whack-a-mole, you know? You fix one thing in society, and something else gets broken. And so there's perpetual causes to fight for, and perpetual things to do. So it's not that the externals change, but the motives change. The cancerous cell is eating and breathing and excreting, and the healthy soul is eating and breathing and excreting and multiplying. But one is serving the body and one is serving itself. So everything we do, if we start switching, Rishikesha, Rishikena, Sevanam, Bhakti, Ruchite, it's not that we're going to do different things. Of course, if we're eating meat, having illicit sex, taking intoxication, gambling, then we'll do different things. But generally, it's not that we're going to do different things, but we're going to do things for a different master. We're going to do things for the pleasure of the real master instead of doing things for a false master, for something independently. And as we start trying to do things for Krishna, we're not going to be successful at it in our illusioned or sleeping state. But we're going to try. We're going to make an effort to switch our master from our senses and mind to Krishna. And Krishna will see that endeavor, and he will see, oh, you have a desire to switch. And he will help us in our illusion state to increase and increase that desire. And he may sometimes give us moments of partial wakefulness where we go, whoa! Just like in a normal sleep, we may wake up for a moment kind of hazy. Oh, what time is it? Whoa. And then we fall back to sleep. So in spiritual life, we may wake up a little bit. Whoa, oh, wow, this is amazing. And we fall back. Like the devotee said to Prabhupada, Prabhupada, sometimes we fall into Maya. Prabhupada said, no, you're always in Maya. Sometimes you fall into Krishna. So, you know, Krishna gives us little glimpses of the awakened state. And those glimpses, the purpose of them is to test our desire. When Krishna gives us a little glimpse, here's how wonderful I am. Here's how wonderful spiritual life is. And does our heart respond with, yes. Yes. Wow, I want that. Then Krishna responds by helping us wake up more and more and more. And once we're awake, then we're able to understand, oh, this is how to do everything for the happiness of the Lord. And when we do things for the happiness of the Lord, then they really benefit society. So we see in the Bhagavatam so many descriptions that when society is run by devotees of the Lord, the amount of exploitation in the world, the amount of suffering, the amount of disease, physical disease, mental disease, the amount of pollution is very, very small. That the earth is prosperous. People are healthy. They're healthy physically. They're healthy mentally. They care for each other. They respect each other. So these are the descriptions in the Bhagavatam of a real Krishna conscious society. So thank you very much. We have, I think you have 10 minutes to 8:40, I believe, for questions. Is that correct?
We can go over a little bit.
Did I go all the way to the end? I wasn't sure if I was supposed to end at 8:30 or 8:40.
That's all right. You can take some questions.
Okay, so we can take some questions. We have one here in the chat window already. If our sleep depends on God, if we use some system and it helps us, how does it work? Well, that's true for everything. Everything depends on God, and yet we also use systems to help us. You know, my walking depends on God, but I still use shoes. My driving my car depends on God, but I have a car. So the fact that we use some systems to help us doesn't mean that God is not ultimately the controller. He's the controller of whether or not the systems work. We have the freedom to use systems to help us. Very nice question. Anybody else? Yes, Peru.
You mentioned how sometimes we have that inner voice, which, you know, it doesn't, we have all kinds of material desires. And that was, it's such a conflict because sometimes you do want to be sincere and honest and not, yeah, not pretend to be this pure devotee who only wants to serve Krishna. But at the same time, you don't want to act on every material desire you have, because then I'll just leave Krishna consciousness.
Well, it would be crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think anybody acts on every material desire they have. They'd be kind of an animal. What we can do with our material desires, this wasn't something I talked about at all in today's class, but in the purport for verse 71, Prabhupada says, only by devotional service and detachment can one perform the process of linking with the Absolute. So today I didn't speak about detachment, but as you're bringing this up. So detachment basically means it's not aversion. Let's say that we believe that something is true. And based on that belief, we act. And at a certain point, we find out that what we believe to be true is an absolute, total, complete lie. It's a complete falsity. Once that's happened, we're no longer able to see the thing as true. Do we all have this experience?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. I mean, I'm thinking of how when I was a child, I liked this one television show. And when I visited Hollywood, I think I was about 10, and I went on the set of the show, and I saw that the stairs that apparently led to the upstairs of the house actually led nowhere. You know, and after that, whenever I watched the show, I knew that those stairs led nowhere. You know, a magician. Like a magician does some trick, but once they show you how the trick is done, you can't see the trick for what it is anymore. Yeah, or there's these experiments where you can see videos of this where they tell you to focus on a ball. It's people hitting a ball into a basket or one ball covering another ball. And in the middle of you, and they're asking you to count how many times the ball goes in the basket or how many times the ball covers the other ball. And in the middle of that, in one of them a guy comes out wearing a gorilla suit and stands in the middle and goes like this. And in another one, a guy puts a sock puppet on his hand of a snake and makes these, you know, things with the sock puppet. And afterwards they say, did you see the gorilla or did you see the snake? And you're like, no. Because you were focused on something else. You were focused on the balls. But then once you know that there was a gorilla there or a snake there, when you watch it again, you'll always see it. So what happens is that Prabhupada says we become detached by seeing the naked form of material desires. When we see material desires for what they are, they lose all of their attractiveness. The reason that we have an urge to fulfill material desires is we're seeing them as something other than what they are. We're seeing them in an illusory way. So there's many, many techniques given in the Shastra as to how to see the material desires, emotions, thoughts for what they are. And Krishna talks about like being an ocean, that the rivers come in, but the ocean remains still. Right? This is one of the techniques. Another technique is to bring your mind back wherever the mind wanders, bring it back and fix it on the self. And we find that Krishna also talks about in the Bhagavad Gita about fixing yourself as the observer, understanding that these thoughts and desires and emotions are not ours. Yantra Rudrani Maya, they're a machine. You know, my body gets certain physiological desires. Like my body will have a physiological desire for sleeping or for eating or for sex. You know, it has certain, or it will get a physiological desire if there's some threat. My body will have a physiological desire to fight or to run away. You know, those are just pure physicality. And then there's mental and emotional desires. Right, that I'm thinking, you know, I desire that blue sweater, or you know, whatever, or I desire to make a lot of money, and then so these are mental desires, but the mental desires are no different than the physiological desires. They're something coming from machines that are not me. I'm observing them and I'm identifying with them, but they're not me. And so, rather than either trying to fulfill the desire or to resist the desire, which is attachment and aversion, and just takes us on this bhoga tyaga thing, you know, and it says in the Bhagavatam, we'll end up enjoying the very thing we're trying to resist, which we all have experience of that. We all have experience of having some emotion, some desire, some thought that, you know, we're thinking, oh, I don't think I really want to do that. And so we're resisting, and then eventually we end up doing the thing we're resisting. So rather than either of those, it's a kind of observing. First of all, it's finding what is it I really desire. So we stop fooling ourselves instead of saying, oh, I really desire world peace. You know, and I really desire just love of everybody. I really desire just to serve Krishna, you know, whatever. So to see what it is I desire. Without fear. You know, maybe I desire everybody to worship me, and I desire to have a life of comfort and ease, and, you know, the delicious food and wonderful music and everybody praising me. Maybe those are my real desires. So to see them and to not be afraid of them, not be afraid of seeing them. You know, we're terrified that if I see those desires, I'll just have to run and fulfill them. But no, let's just look at them and say, okay, that's that desire. And then you can get kind of curious about it. Well, what are those desires, really? You know, I heard one person describing it as kind of like touching them with a long feather, like kind of gently touching them. But what are you? Because like Prabhupada says, to see the naked form of our material desires. So to really see, you know, what are those desires anyway? What are they for? And then maybe we can label them. Oh, well, that's lust, and that's envy. Okay. Oh, look at that. Oh, and that's greediness. Oh, that's fear. Look at that. That's fear. Oh, and that's disgust. You know, and then maybe, oh, well, that's fear. What's hiding under the fear? What's hiding under the fear is insecurity, and what's hiding in, look at that, you know. And then, well, what does that mean? What do all these things mean? Why are there all these desires? Why are there all these emotions? Why are there all these thoughts? Oh, what they really mean is that, you know, I'm just not remembering that I'm a soul. I'm not remembering that Krishna's controlling the world and not me. I'm not remembering that he's my best friend. That's what the meaning of all these is. They're just symptoms of that. you know, it's kind of like if you cut your body and you want to look at it. Oh, my body's cut. There's blood there. What does that mean? You know, what's the meaning of it? Oh, it means that I've touched something that was sharp. So the meaning of all those desires and the meanings of all those emotions is that I'm not situated in reality. That's the meaning. And then I can say thank you for alerting me to that. Just like the blood on my finger alerts me to the fact that there's some breach in my skin. So those material desires and those material emotions, they're alerting me to the fact that I'm separated from Krishna. They're reminding me, oh yeah, okay. Then I can let them go because they've given me their message. They've communicated to me that I'm separate from Krishna. They've communicated to me that I need, if I want to be happy, that I need to serve the master of the senses instead of the senses. So then I can let those desires go. I can let those emotions, those thoughts go. I can release them. And I can't release them by pushing them away, by the way. That's not possible. But I can release my desire to hold on to them. And then they tend to just dissipate. If I'm not holding on to them, they tend to just very quickly dissipate. They just kind of fade away. So this is the, just like the river into the ocean, it doesn't affect the ocean. So this is the detachment that's also very much that Prabhupada refers to in this purport. So I think we should end here. Thank you very much. Thank you for this opportunity. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Hare Krishna.